Hello, everyone. Welcome to Congresswoman DeGette's live telephone town hall meeting. I'm Christopher Eisenma, Congresswoman DeGette's Communications Director, and I'll be your MC for the evening. If at any time you'd like to ask the Congresswoman DeGette a question, please press star 3 on your phone. As many of you know, health insurance reform has been at the top of the list for Congress this year. Just recently, the Energy and Commerce Committee passed the health care reform bill that will soon come to the full House of Representatives. As a member of the Democratic leadership as Chief Deputy Whip and as a Vice Chair of the Committee on Energy and Commerce, Congresswoman DeGette has been playing a key role in moving this legislation through committee and will be central to ensuring its passage in the full House. We welcome your questions and thoughts on health insurance reform tonight. If you're interested in asking Congresswoman DeGette a question at any time, please press star 3 at any time during the town hall. Once pressed, you will enter a queue to register your question, then prompted to ask your question. For those of you interested in keeping up with Congresswoman DeGette's activities in the 111th Congress, please go to our website at www.house.gov/DeGette to sign up for our e-newsletter. I will now turn over the call to Congresswoman DeGette, who will open with a few brief remarks. Remember, if you're interested in asking the Congresswoman a question tonight, please press star 3 and you will be connected. Congresswoman DeGette?
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to my telephone town hall meeting. I've had a series of these events on the telephone. I find it's an easy way to talk with my constituents while they're in the comfort of their own homes. As Chris told you, one of the top issues on the congressional agenda right now is the issue of health care reform. But before I talk with you about what the urgent need for health care reform, what we're working on in Congress, and where I see this going, I do want to mention one small victory we had last week. The United States House of Representatives, by an overwhelming bipartisan majority, passed a complete overhaul of our nation's food safety laws. This is an issue that has been brought very close to home over the last few years with recall after recall of everything from peanut butter to spinach to meat, even dog food. And my committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, has been working for a long time to update our nation's food safety laws, which are frankly broken. And last week, due to the efforts of my committee and a lot of other folks, we were able to pass the most comprehensive food safety bill in 30 years. This bill gave enhanced powers to the Food and Drug Administration, allowing them to have more inspectors, more funding, allowing them to go to a science-based system for food safety to see which plants they should inspect, but also to give them subpoena power so that they can get records in a timely fashion when there's a foodborne illness outbreak. Two provisions that I've been working on for a long time were included in the bill, I'm happy to say. One of them would give the Food and Drug Administration mandatory recall authority so that if tainted food is found, then that food can be recalled by the FDA. Many of my constituents are shocked to know that the recall procedures to this date have been voluntary on the part of the food producers, and oftentimes when they are really not complying with the laws, they're reluctant to recall the food. The second thing that I was able to have included in the bill was the ability to trace food from field to the fork so that if there is a foodborne illness outbreak, we're able to find immediately where exactly that food came from and to remove it. This not only protects the safety of consumers, it also protects the integrity of the industry. I think back on the salsa terrible situation last year where the entire tomato crop was wiped out because people thought that the tomatoes were tainted, only to learn that it was jalapenos from a field in Texas. So I'm pleased that these provisions were included in the bill. I'm pleased that the bill passed the House. Now we're waiting action in the Senate in the fall, and I'm hoping that for the third time this year, I will be standing near President Obama while he signs important legislation. The first two, of course, were the executive order overturning President Bush's restrictions on stem cell research and the bill giving the FDA authority over tobacco regulation. And so with that, I'd like to spend the balance of this evening talking about the health care bill that's pending in Congress, why I think we need it, what we're working on, and then really what I'm looking forward to is answering your questions about the bill, what we're attempting to do, and what I see going forward in the fall. Most people know now that the crisis in our healthcare system is very, very real in this country. The broken healthcare system in this country is going to cost us as much as $248 billion in lost productivity this year. And providing healthcare for the uninsured costs American families $100 billion every year. This is the fastest growing segment of our economy, and by 2016, the cost of an employer-sponsored family health insurance plan is going to be $24,000, which is an increase of 84%. That would mean that by 2016, most American households would be spending 45% of their income on health insurance. Many of my listeners probably know that the leading cause of personal bankruptcy in this country right now is health care costs and people's inability to pay for them. 47 million Americans are uninsured right now, and that number is projected to only grow. Those are people, not only do they have to go to the emergency room for their health care, it is causing them not to get good preventive care, and it is costing every family in this country because of increasing costs within the system. And so we need to reform our health care system, not only because we cannot get our economy back on track if we don't do that, but also our health care results for Americans will continue to decrease. We have the most expensive health care system in the world, but in many of the indices, we have one of the worst results, and that's just unacceptable. So what Congress is talking about doing is passing a health care plan that will help all Americans, that will not only help the 47 million Americans who don't have health insurance, but will also help every American who has health insurance and is satisfied with that insurance right now. And I want to talk about that for a minute. Under the plan we're considering, people who like their health insurance right now will be able to stay in that health insurance. However, those people, number one, they cannot be declined for health insurance because of a pre-existing condition. Number two, if they move or they lose their job, they cannot lose their health insurance too. And number three, if they have catastrophic medical expenses or a chronic illness, they won't reach up against a lifetime cap on medical expenses. And that's for the people who have health insurance right now. What we're doing, and in the bill that passed my committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee last week, what it looked like was, for most Americans, they would continue to stay in their employer-based health insurance if they want to. We set up what we call an insurance exchange. And what this basically is a way for private insurance plans as well as a government-run insurance plan to compete against each other. All of those plans in the exchange would have to have certain minimum conditions involved in them. And Americans would be, and small businesses would be able to buy into that exchange and purchase insurance for themselves or for their employees. And I think it's important to stress, because there's a lot of misinformation out there, that the public option in the exchange would be subject to all of the same rules and regulations as the private insurance companies in the exchange. So people say to me, why would you have a public option? And the basic reason is to keep the insurance companies honest and to keep competition within the system, because the public plan would be run by the government. It would be a nonprofit entity, and so it would take the profit motive that the insurance companies out of the system. People would not be forced to enroll in that public option. But if they did decide to, then they would be able to get all of the benefits that they might in private insurance. Private insurance companies will be forced to rethink their profit motive and to put their money into cost-saving ways so that Americans who are enrolled, who wish to enroll in their private insurance plans will have cost savings. And we have a number of quality provisions in the bill as well. Doctors and non-insurance companies will be in charge of health care decisions. And we have money in the bill, money I helped put into the bill, for medical education. When you're putting 47 million more people into the healthcare system of this country, you're going to need more doctors, in particular primary care physicians, nurses, and others. And so we give assistance for graduate medical education in the bill, and we also give better reimbursement rates to these physicians through Medicare and other public health care plans. Small businesses would benefit through this plan because now they would be able to get access to this health insurance exchange, which would give them the benefits of large group rates that heretofore have only been enjoyed by large employers. Also, small businesses would get a tax credit if they offer coverage for people. And very small businesses would be exempted from the requirement that everybody be enrolled, all their employees be enrolled, or they would have to pay an 8% payroll tax. So all in all, this will be a good deal for consumers and a good deal for small businesses. For all businesses, large and small, there will be a benefit because the cost of the uninsured will no longer be shifted onto employers. And cost control measures will be designed to increase employers' effectiveness. So the status of the bill, as I mentioned, the bill passed through my committee late last week. And for people who say that it's not accepted by a wide number of people, my committee is very diverse. We have people on that committee from rural Arkansas and from New York City. And they were all able to negotiate together and work out a bill that they think will be equitable and fair for all of their constituents. That bill now will go to the Rules Committee in the House, where there are bills from two other committees pending. And those three bills will be put together into one. They'll be considered on the House floor sometime next fall. At the same time, the Senate, as you've probably read in the paper, is considering two bills in two committees. The Senate Healthcare Committee has already passed its bill, and the Senate Finance Committee is working on a bill. And so those two bills will be passed. The deadline in the Senate is September 15th. Then those will go to the Senate floor. The House and the Senate will work together then in a conference committee to come out with one joint bill, and we hope that President Obama will have that bill. In fact, we plan that President Obama will have that bill on his desk by the end of the year. Again, I think for a variety of reasons, the economy, the health of our country, we've got to have health care reform in this country, and it needs to be comprehensive so that it will cover everybody and so that it will be affordable for all Americans. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great, thanks. Again, if you're interested in asking Congresswoman to get a question, please press *3 and you will be connected. We'll start with a question from Tim, who had a question about affordability of health care under the House plan. Tim, are you there to ask your question?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hi,
Diana.
Here. Hi.
Okay, I understand that there'll be a requirement in any of these bills for everyone to buy health insurance. Is that correct?
Yes, there will be a requirement in these bills that all Americans have health insurance. And to make sure that all Americans can get health insurance, we do a couple of things. The first one is we raise the eligibility for Medicaid to 133% of poverty. So people up to 133% of poverty can be enrolled in Medicaid at no cost to themselves. For people between 133% and 400% of poverty, we're going to have premium assistance for those individuals. And what that would mean is the government would help those people pay a portion of their premiums on a sliding scale so that families would get some help with their premiums. So there will be help with people. If people don't enroll in their health insurance, then they're going to have to pay a penalty too because they're going to be an indirect burden on our health costs in this country.
Next, we have a question from Beth, who had a question about the funding of the public option. Beth, are you there to ask the question of the Congresswoman?
Yes,
Beth.
I am.
Hi, Beth. How are you?
Hi. It's Beth McCann, Diana.
Oh, hi, Beth. How are you?
I'm fine. Say, first, I wanted to say that I just want to encourage you to make sure you stick with the public option. I know there's been a lot of reaction when Congress people have been out in their communities, and I haven't had a chance to talk to you about this, but I'm very supportive. I'm a single-payer supporter, but that's not in the works right now. So I just want to encourage you to hang tough on the public option. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about the funding mechanism, and I didn't hear all of the last exchange, so I don't know if you've already covered that, but if not, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, well, the public option is a very important component of this bill, because if we don't have a public option, then what will happen is there will be no cost containment on the insurance companies. And so even if we require everybody to have health insurance and we set up an insurance exchange and we do all of this, if we don't have some mechanism to help contain costs and to help have competition in the system, then what will happen is insurance costs will just continue to go up. And so today I had a press conference with Speaker Pelosi, and Speaker Pelosi clearly said that we are going to keep the public option, and there's a strong sentiment for that in the House as well. We're going to have to fight hard to do this in the Senate. It's important to know that the public option, it's not funded by the government. They're going to have to compete just like the private plans in the exchange. So if I signed up for the public option, for example, and I was between 133 and 400% of poverty, I could get some premium assistance, but then the rest of the premium I would pay. And I would get a choice of several different options within the plan. But the thing that will keep the public option competitive is the Secretary of HHS's ability to negotiate those rates within the plan so they can keep the cost as low as possible. We think that will create competition with private insurance companies. I want to let the rest of the callers know that was State Representative Beth McCann, who has fought tirelessly for health care over all these years and is doing a wonderful job in the state legislature for us.
Great. Remember, if you're interested in asking Congresswoman to get a question tonight, please press star 3 and you'll be connected. Next, we'll take a question about affordability. From John. John, are you on the line? John?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Hi, John. Diana DeGette.
Hi, Diana. How are you?
Good.
Good. I've heard a lot of talk about the purpose of this bill being to reduce the growth of the cost of health care, not necessarily to overall reduce the cost, but rather to slow it down how quickly it gets more expensive. So specifically, my question is, how is healthcare going to be affordable to everybody if reducing the cost is not a part of the goal?
Well, actually, John, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, the increase in healthcare costs is so expensive that it's going to be an average of $24,000 by the year 2016, which is most families could never pay $24,000 a year for health care insurance. So you're right. The first goal of this is what we call bending the curve. In other words, stopping this rapid growth of health care, of increase of health care costs. But the second thing we need to do, and an issue that I've been working very hard with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, is, and he's from Rhode Island, is trying to build quality measures into our health care. We have one of the nation's premier examples of this right here in Denver with Denver Health. Faced with decreasing reimbursements and increasing health care costs, Denver Health has instituted a number of quality measures which have improved patient outcomes and quality and also decreased costs. One of the things we talk about a lot is electronic medical records and information technology, which not only streamlines the system and makes it cheaper, but it also gives better information to the patients and it improves their health care quality. There are a number of other quality measures that we can do, and we are working on building those into the bill. But at first, we're going to have to bend the curve so that we don't pay $24,000 per family per year. But then you're right, we need to begin to get more and more cost savings. One of the things that's been a little frustrating to us is the way the Congressional Budget Office estimates how much bills are going to cost. Because when we put all of our prevention and quality measures, when we say we want to have all of these, the Congressional Budget Office says, well, these won't save money because people will live longer. And I say, well, you know what? I think it will save money if we give people more preventative care. And if they live longer, that's only even a bonus. So these are very difficult issues, but we think that in order to provide quality health care and prevention for everybody and reduce the cost, we're going to have to get everybody enrolled and they're going to have quality insurance.
Next, we have a question from Marilyn. Marilyn, about Medicare. Marilyn, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Marilyn?
Hi, Marilyn.
Yes.
It's Diana DeGette.
Hi, dear. I want to tell you, number one, I am so thrilled with your support of the whole healthcare reform. I've been so interested in health. I went up to in 1992. I was with a union, and I went to Canada and looked at single payer, that was such a good experience, and people were really, really happy in Canada that we talked to. And I've heard people talk about in Denver, getting back to now, about Medicare, and there people are generally saying, I wonder what kind of changes are going to happen to us in Medicare. Not that we're against it. We just want to prepare, we want to share. What are the changes that might happen?
Well, you know, Marilyn, I'm glad you asked the question about senior citizens and Medicare, because actually people who are in Medicare will still continue to be enrolled in Medicare. They'll still be able to get the benefits of Medicare. One of the things that we do that's really going to help senior citizens in Medicare, we fill part of the Part D drug program donut hole. And any senior who's listening to this knows exactly what I'm talking about. When Congress passed the Medicare prescription drug benefits in 2005, in order to be able to fund the bill, they made this donut hole, which is a portion of the prescription drug fee has to be paid by the senior citizen. We were able to reduce the gap by $500 in 2011, and then over the years after that, it's completely filled in. And there's a couple of other things we did. We eliminated co-payments for preventative services in Medicare. We improved low-income subsidy programs to help Medicare coverage for people on lower incomes. A lot of other things that we did to help strengthen Medicare. But people who are enrolled in Medicare right now will stay in Medicare under our plan.
Great. Next, we have a question from John, who has a question about the process. John, are you there to ask your question?
Is this
John?
Me? Yep.
Hi, John. It's Diana DeGette.
Yes, ma'am. How are you this evening?
I'm good.
Question I have is, I've seen on some of the talk shows, and I watch all of them, that this bill is well over 1,000 pages as it stands right now. And one senator said that he hasn't read it because he doesn't have two lawyers on his staff to understand it. My question is, have you read this bill and totally understand it?
Well, let me tell you, I don't know if this is good or bad. It's usually not considered to be good, but in this case it might be. I actually am a lawyer, and I have read the bill. I read the draft version that we put out about a month ago, and I did understand it because I've been working on healthcare issues for many, many years. As I mentioned to you, since we put that bill out for discussion, it has now gone through three separate committees, including my Energy and Commerce Committee. And we had a number of amendments when we were in the committee last week, voting on this bill and what we call marking the bill up. And so I did read all of those amendments as we considered those amendments. What I intend to do in the next few weeks is read the new revised version of the bill that came through the committee. But remember, as it goes through, we're going to have more and different drafts. So I intend to keep up with those because, as I said, I'm the vice chairman of the committee that has the primary oversight in the House over the bill. So I figure I definitely need to know what's in there, and I need to make sure that what's in there is going to be good for my constituents.
Great. Next, we have a question from Dan from Southwest Denver, who has a question about private and public options and how they would compete. Dan, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Dan. Diana DeGette.
Hi, Diana. My question is basically why you think the public and the private plans are going to be able to compete with one another when the federal government can print as much money as it wants, can go into as much debt as it wants, and has to show no profit motive. Why or how would we expect any private health insurance company to be able to compete against that? And why do we need
it in the first place if
there's over 1,300 options already available in the marketplace for healthcare right now? 1,300.
Well, Dan, one of the things that people don't really realize a lot of times is and actually many of the listeners won't be surprised to hear this, is that one of the very few, maybe the only industry that is exempt from the antitrust laws is the insurance industry. And in 84% of this country, there is no competition among insurance plans because only one plan covers those areas. For example, down in Pueblo, Colorado, there's only one plan that covers almost all, I think it's over 80% of Pueblo County. And so what's happened over the years is those private insurance companies, since they don't have competition in those areas, they just raise their rates, or they decide what they're going to cover or not cover, or what the co-payments are going to be or whatever on their own. They don't have to compete against somebody else. So the concept of this insurance exchange is that there will be more choice of plans within every area, every region of this country. And if you have the public plan in there, then they don't have that profit motive, so they can be making health care decisions based on actual cost. So you say to yourself, well, then how can the insurance companies compete against that? And I will say that there are a number of different efficiencies that they can build in. They can build in electronic medical records and good old American competitiveness. So and also let me point out again, it is worth saying again, the government will not be funding the public plan. The public plan will be funded just the way private plans in the exchange are funded, and that is by people's premiums. And then if people are getting some premium assistance for the lower incomes, they will get some premium assistance, but that's true in the public or the private plans. Let me just give you one example. In Grand Junction, Colorado, they have a very good insurance system there that's been able to operate in a way that gives very good patient outcomes and is very, very low priced compared to much of the rest of the country. And we expect we'll be able to get some of that cost containment and some of that kind of intuition and competitiveness through this exchange that we're going to have.
Again, if you're interested in asking Congresswoman to get a question, please press *3 and you will be connected. Next, we're going to take a question from Joanna, who has a question about pre-existing conditions. Joanna, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Joanna. It's Diana DeGette.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call, Mr. Guest.
Sure.
Excuse me. I'm very curious about the dynamic. I know that you were talking about the poverty level. I have a pre-existing health condition, and while I'm lucky enough to get insurance through my work, should I be made redundant, I'd be in a very sorry situation. What kind of options can I look for in this new plan?
Well, you're exactly right. You would be in trouble, and so many Americans have seen this. They have a pre-existing condition, and so when they change jobs or in this unfortunate job market, they lose their jobs, and then they can't get new insurance because they have a pre-existing condition. Our bill for either the exchange that I was talking about or even for people under their current insurance says that they cannot be denied insurance because of a pre-existing condition. And so, therefore, you know, your insurance has to keep you enrolled. And by the way, if you get fired or downsized or you lose your job or you switch jobs, you cannot lose your insurance simply because you lose your job. And that should give all Americans, but particularly people with pre-existing conditions, a real sense of a peace of mind. And I'll just share one personal piece of information. One of my children has a chronic disease, and I've spent many, many nights, like so many parents have in this country, wondering what will happen after she graduates from college if she has to go out and get insurance on her own. Under this plan, she would be able to get insurance because nobody could exclude her for a pre-existing condition. And by the way, something else under this plan is college students and even recent graduates up to the age of 26 would be able to stay on their parents' insurance while they get on their feet after graduating from college.
Next, we'll take a question from Brock from Castle Rock, who has a question about abortion funding included in the House bill. Brock?
Hi. Yes, hello?
Hi, this is Diana DeGette.
How you doing, Diana? I'm Brock.
Good. How are you, Brock?
Good. Hey, I had two separate issues that I brought up to the screener, and I think the other one kind of applies more to me. The fact that all Americans, no one in this country can be denied health care. But my question, I guess, is about illegal aliens more than the abortion issue. We have a big immigration problem in this country. And under this, and illegal aliens can get their coverage, but taxpayers are on the hook for it eventually. I think you'd be in agreement with that. Under this plan, where would the new money be coming from for illegal aliens that would have to be covered under any plan? Where would the money come from?
Let me say that this bill does nothing to in one way or the other to change the status of people who are not here legally right now. And I do agree with you. We need to get a grip on the problem we have in this country with people who are here in an undocumented way. We need to do that in a way that's not through a health care plan. Later this fall or later this year, maybe we need a comprehensive immigration policy that's going to help us figure out what we do with folks who are here. But this bill really doesn't talk about that situation.
Next, we have a question from Joshua, who has a question about small businesses. Joshua, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Hello. Hello, Representative.
Hi, Joshua. It's Diana DeGette. Good. How are you?
First of all, a follow-up to a question, and this arrived after I got in the queue, in response to your question from John about process. Am I to understand that you voted through, you passed a bill through committee as vice chair without reading the bill?
No, I just said I did read the bill.
I thought you said that you did not read everything that was in markup as it had gone through committee.
No. What I said is I read the original bill, and then I read all of the amendments that went through the markup of my committee.
I think you said you were going to read all of the amendments.
No, I did read them. I had many happy hours sitting there reading the amendments.
Okay. All right. Now, isn't it true, though, you're talking about small businesses. wouldn't it be easier just to allow small businesses to group together and negotiate as groups in order to get large coverage, and that has been consistently opposed? Wouldn't that be an easier way of allowing small businesses to get coverage rather than offering this plan? And by the way, also, it's not my choice if I get to keep my doctor. It's my employer's choice, because my employer is the one who decides whether or not to dump me into the public option, not me. So it's not my choice. It's my employer's choice.
Well, first of all, let me say that right now many states do have state laws that allow small businesses to band together and to get insurance, but not all states have those laws. And even for the states that do, the small businesses oftentimes are not as able to get the purchasing power to get the same kind of health care plans for their employees. And being a small business, it's extremely difficult. I was a small business person myself, and it's extremely difficult to be able to pay for that high insurance with everything else you're trying to pay for your employees. So I do agree with the idea that small businesses can band together, but frankly, I don't think it would give them the purchasing power that this exchange would give, because it would be a very powerful way to allow everybody to get this insurance for their employees. In terms of being able to keep your doctor, what I had said was that people who are in private insurance right now can stay in that insurance, and at least for the short term, the public option will be limited to people who don't have insurance right now. It could then expand over time. The exchange will be open to all employers as another choice for covering their employees. But even if you do go into the exchange, there's no your doctor may well be in there, because this is one of the parts of the bill that hasn't been fully decided yet. But many people think that at least in the initial time, that the public option in the exchange would use the list of doctors who provide Medicare services if they want to do that. And that would include most of the doctors people go to right now.
Next, we have a question from Kevin, who has a question about paying for health care reform. Kevin, are you on the line?
I am.
Hi, Kevin. Diana DeGette.
Hi, Congressman DeGette. Thank you very much for having this meeting. I'm concerned about all the money that's being spent, not just TARP and stimulus and cap and trade and nationalizing cars and insurance and all that kind of stuff. I'm concerned that if this Congressional Budget Office numbers are right, that we're going way overboard in all of the expenses that we have, both in health care and other things. I heard it estimated recently that the unfunded liability associated with Medicare and Medicaid and the Indian Affairs Health Department and all the veteran stuff is all bankrupt, and therefore I just am against this whole thing. Have you ever considered having private solutions and not going more into debt? Our country is really can't stand it.
But you know, I agree with you on one thing you said. I don't think our country should go more into debt over this health care plan. And this is something that I don't think the media has focused on enough. I'm a big deficit hawk myself. And I think that whatever health care reform bill we pass has got to be paid for through reforms to the system. And the bill that we passed out of my committee on Friday was funded exactly that way. It was not funded by additional taxes on most Americans. It was not funded by deficit spending. But consider this. If we don't have health care reform, a continuing percentage of our gross national product is going to be health care costs, and it's going to really inhibit our ability to compete in a global economy as we go forward. So how do we pay for this? Well, the first thing we do is we increase efficiency in the health sector. I talked about that earlier. We eliminate administrative waste. We expand cost-saving wellness measures, and we also improve the accuracy of payment in current health care programs. The other thing we do, we put into place electronic medical records, which, as I said, not only help improve patient outcomes, but also improve the efficiencies in the system. In the bill that we passed on Friday, one thing we did, which I'm strongly in support of, is we allow the Secretary of HHS to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for pharmaceutical prices under Medicare. And that'll save billions and billions of dollars. So I'm also very sensitive about the cost, but we're going to pay for it through reforms in the system and not through deficit spending.
Next, we have a question from Nicole, who has a question about the single payer system. Nicole, are you on the line?
I am.
Hi, Nicole. It's Diana DeGette.
Hi, Diana DeGette. I'm Nicole Martin, also an attorney. So I'm sensitive to these issues, and I'm especially sensitive to this forum that you've chosen because it doesn't permit follow-up questions, for example, from, I think his name might have been Kevin, the gentleman who said, you know, my doctor or my employer chooses my plan, not me. And so if his employer, the follow-up question would have been, naturally, that his employer would have the power to opt him out of the private sector and put him into the public sector.
Well, first of all, let me say, Nicole, that when I do a telephone town hall meeting like this, I really do mean it to be a dialogue with a number of constituents. And so I think in the last telephone town hall meeting, we reached 6,000 or 7,000 constituents just in 1 hour-long phone call. And one reason why we don't have follow-up questions is so that everybody can get their questions in. And oftentimes, just like you chimed in just now, someone else will ask the follow-up questions. So, if I have a telephone town hall meeting, I can talk to many thousands of my constituents at once, and I feel that that's very helpful to have that dialogue. With respect to your specific question about in an employer plan, in an employer plan, then they will choose that plan for you. And what you described, Nicole, is the current system. Right now what happens is most people's employers choose their health care plans. Oftentimes those are managed care plans where there's one set of doctors that they can go to. Sometimes they can have the choice of several different plans. That wouldn't really change under this system, except for over time it might allow some people to go into the public option. But let me repeat this. I don't think I may have been clear enough, but the public or the insurance exchange in general, which will be insurance companies and the public option competing against each other, at first that exchange will only be available to businesses and individuals who do not have insurance insurance coverage right now. And then what will happen over time is as more people enroll in these systems, as they become more competitive, then more employers and individuals will have the option of going into the exchange. But as I said also, I expect that in the public option, just as much as in private insurance plans, people will still have as much ability to choose their doctors or more as they have right now in our current employer-based system in this country.
Next up, we have a question from Dawn, who has a question about those who would be put into the public option. Dawn, are you online?
I am here.
Hi, Dawn. It's Diana DeGette.
Thank you for taking my question, Representative.
Absolutely.
Representative from Louisiana has introduced an amendment to the current health care bill to remove the exemption of Congress for participation in the public plan. Will you support that amendment and insist that be adopted as a condition for
Absolutely.
The bill?
Absolutely.
Okay.
My view is that if I'm going to support this insurance exchange and the public plan, then I need to be willing to go into that plan just like every other American.
Next, we have a question from Dan from Southwest Denver asking about how the public options and the private plans will compete with each other. Dan, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi, Dan. I wanted to ask a follow-up question from my earlier one. You mentioned several times that people will be able to keep their current employer-based coverage, but I'm looking at the bill right now from the House website, and it clearly states on page 16 that insurance companies cannot accept any new enrollment after January 1st, the date that the bill takes effect. So, you know, again, I feel that I don't see any way in which the current private insurance market we have today will survive with the government involved, with these types of restrictions, and with the complete inability to compete against it. And, you know, I'm concerned, too. I heard a quote from Barney Frank saying that he's all for a single-payer government-run health system, and he thinks this public option is the best way to get that in place by starting with this.
Well, first of all, let me say that just that one phrase on that page of the bill is not describing the way the whole system works. And I will say it again, if you read the whole bill, you'll see what I mean. What happens is that at least in the short run, before 2013, what will happen is that that the people enrolled in current employer-based plans will stay on those plans. The insurance exchange will be set up, and that'll be the plans who choose to compete in that, the private plans who choose to compete in the exchange, and the public option. They'll be competing in the exchange, but the people who can enroll in the exchange at the beginning will be small businesses and individuals who don't have the health insurance right now. In terms of what Barney Frank had said about the single-payer option, there are members of Congress who do support a single-payer option, and I have many constituents who support a single-payer option. I also have many constituents who oppose a single-payer option. They feel like that to their view, we heard one caller earlier say that she thought the Canadian system worked well. I've heard other people say that it doesn't work well. Now, what we're talking about here is reforming our entire healthcare system, enrolling up to 47 million more Americans in health insurance, and trying to get efficiencies in the system and preventive care so that it works for everybody and reduces the cost. If we don't have consensus around something as dramatic as a single payer, then not only do I think we can't adopt that, but I don't think we could adopt it in Congress. So you know, one thing that's great about the U.S. House of Representatives, we have 435 people there, each from a different congressional district, each with different constituents and different views. We saw this in the committee last week where we had rural members from Arkansas and liberal members from New York City and Chicago, and yet we were all able to come together around one bill. So I guess, you know, the old phrase is, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I think everybody from every perspective, single payer proponent or not proponent or whatever, can say, okay, let's find out where we can get consensus. Let's get this health care going for the future of our economy and the health of our citizens.
Next, we have a question from Steve, who has a question about preventative care. Steve, are you online?
I am. I'm here.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Congresswoman DeGette. How are you doing this evening?
I'm great. How about you?
Not bad. My question is, what provisions would be in the bill to help overcome a lot of the social problems that we're having? What I mean by that is the rise in obesity rates and the increase in rates of diabetes, lots of things that we're seeing coming from that outcome of poor eating habits and lack of exercise. So what provisions will be in the bill to help overcome those social problems? Because, well, if we don't have enough healthy people in the system can't work.
Steve, thank you for that question. And as you just referenced, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, is the fastest growing disease in this country. And a lot of type 2 diabetes can be controlled by exercise and diet and also good medication. But if you don't have somebody enrolled in a health care plan, then they can't get preventative care. And that's the problem for 47 million Americans and millions more who have catastrophic insurance or other types of insurance that don't give them the kind of checkups that they need. And so the first step is really to get everybody enrolled in health care in this country. And then the second step is to do some of the things that I mentioned Senator Whitehouse and I are trying to do. Put some prevention in there. Give incentives for doctors to provide preventative care and even give reimbursements for that. And we have a lot of that in the bill right now. I'm hoping as we work the bill forward, we can get even more prevention in the bill because that'll really help with type 2 diabetes. It'll help with so many other issues. And then, of course, I think that'll not only save money in the long run, but it will contribute to positive health outcomes.
Great. We have time for two more questions. One of those will be from Mary, who has a question about the cost of doing nothing. Mary, are you on the line?
Yes, Diana. This is actually Mary Sprout. And
Hi,
about the cost of doing nothing. Our healthcare premiums have been going up very fast. They're now more than our house payment was. And I got on the call a little bit late, and so I don't know if you addressed what the current proposal would be to address that issue.
Well, one of the reasons why we need to have national health care reform, and I did mention this at the beginning, is that our health care costs are going up so much. I think it's going to be 18% of GDP within 10 years. And the average American family is going to be paying up to $22,000, I think, in the next 10 years. So if we don't control something, not only are we going to continue with our dubious record of being the most expensive country in the world, but it's going to take up an increasing amount of our budget that we could be using to be competitive around the world. It really is truly crippling that we can't control our health care costs. And as you know, some of the best ways to control health care costs are through enrolling everybody in insurance, giving competition in the insurance market, getting people so that they're involved in their health care decisions and not using the emergency room as a primary provider. And in addition, there are many, many quality measures that need to be put into the bill.
Great. And our last question goes to Vivian, who has a question about long-term care. Vivian, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Vivian.
Hi, Congresswoman Duquette. How are you?
I'm
and
good. How are you?
Doing this. Fine. Thanks for doing this. My question is, of course, trying to keep up with everything that's going on has been kind of crazy. But I want to know if long-term care is still on the table, as well as people who are 55 to 64 to buy into Medicare.
The long-term care issue is very much on the table, and I think in the committee draft that we just passed, there are some provisions for paying for long-term care, which is so important for so many Americans. I don't, through my committee, the bill that we passed, we didn't really have the proposal for paying for people from age 55 to 64 into Medicare. Part of the reason is it would be so expensive to do that. But I know that that provision is under consideration in some of the Senate bills, and that may well both be under discussion when the bill comes to the House floor in September, and also when it comes to the conference committee after the House and Senate finish their deliberations. A lot of people argue very strongly for people who are close to my age, frankly, being able to buy into Medicare if they can't get other insurance. But we really have to look at the price tag of that and figure out how we would pay for that versus enrolling them in the exchange or in employer-based options. So that I think an earlier caller talked about how do we pay for all of this, and we need to be very sensitive. We call it budget neutral, and what that means is we're not adding to the deficit as we pay for these things. Well, that's our last caller, and I hope everybody enjoyed this conversation. This is a very, very complicated area, and so I would ask you, if you want to know more about the legislation, please visit my website. It's www.house.gov/deget. And you can go on there. You can see details of the healthcare legislation and what I'm doing. You can also sign up for my e-newsletter. And we send this e-newsletter out once a week. It's very short, and then it has links to different issues that you might be interested in. And so you can sign up for that to get more updates. Also, please feel free to call my district office here in Denver at 303-844-4988 if you need more information or if I can help you with any issue that you have with the federal agency. I'm hoping that we'll do another one of these town hall meetings before the end of the month, before Congress goes back into session, and then we'll continue to do them as the bill moves along through the fall so that I can have even more specific answers to some of the specific questions about what the bill covers and what it doesn't. In the meantime, I hope everyone has a great August. Good luck getting your kids back to school if your kids are going back to school this month, and enjoy those precious few last moments of our wonderful, wonderful lifestyle here. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks everyone for joining the call tonight. If you were unable to ask your question, stay on the line and you can leave a message for the Congresswoman. Thanks everybody. Bye.